Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dan Snow's History. I met a listener the other day, and she came up to me. She said, I was listening to all of your history hits on a journey driving across Europe. And the first thing that came to her mind as a source of praise, she said, they're short. So... thank you. But she also did say, it's annoying having to listen to the advert on the front. And you know what? I understand that. That's why I keep telling you in the advert to go and subscribe to History Hit TV, because there are no adverts if you listen to it on our app. They're all there, advert-free, all the back catalogue of podcasts, all the new ones, historyhit.tv, go and listen to that. But the second point is, on the advert thing, it's important to say, like, the advert is currently what is paying for History Hit. Like, that is how we're making all this work. That's how I'm able to, go to Vindolanda and do that cool podcast with the Burleys this week. It's working. It's paying for the excellent Laura to find the best guests for this podcast. It's paying for the brilliant Ollie to come and film this extraordinary Dutch resistance heroine who escaped death at the hands of the Nazis in Ravensbrück. Me and Ollie were filming her with actual cameras yesterday. That was paid for by the adverts that are annoying. It's paying for a load of geophysical surveys of an exciting British battlefield that we may be able to reveal the location of in the next few months. So thank you for listening to those adverts. I hope you continue listening into the autumn, into the fall, because we've got lots of exciting stuff coming up. This one is also exciting. This is Professor Susanna Lipscomb. She's been on this podcast so many times, she might as well be hosting it. Professor Susanna Lipscomb is one of my oldest friends in history. She's incredibly talented. She's a Tudor historian. She's also a TV presenter, broadcaster in her own right. She received the ultimate accolade the other day from the one and only Hilary Mantel, author of the greatest trilogy of books in the English language. She wrote at the back of one of her books, anyone who's interested in the subject, go and read the wonderful Susanna Lipscomb. I mean, you can die happy when you get that written about you from such a genius. So this is an episode about one of her latest books. She's produced a history of magic. If you do want to go to History Hit TV and become a subscriber, like thousands of people at the moment, I mean, it's just wild over there, please go to historyhit.tv, sign up using the code POD1, P-O-D-1, and you get to listen to all these podcasts without advertisements on the front. Also, you get all the back episodes, which are not available anywhere else in the world. So I'll see you over there. In the meantime, enjoy this episode with Professor Susanna Lipscomb. Professor Susanna Lipscomb, welcome back on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here. Always lovely to see you.
I mean, you've been on so many times, it must be getting very boring. But the reason you've been on this time is because you keep writing these goddamn books. This is extraordinary.
Well, this time I've just written the foreword. I haven't written the whole book. But, you know, I'm trying.
You're a powerhouse. And, you know, starting a family, I don't know how you do it, really. This is a kind of history of magic and superstition. If you hold the view that I do, that once we understand something, we call it science, but like magic doesn't really kind of exist. So why write a history of it? What's the point?
Well, I suppose throughout the centuries that have passed, there's been so much that people didn't understand, right? There's been so much that's been inexplicable. And magic helps you tilt the balance in favour of trying to control what you can't control. I think that's why people have wanted to harness the power of magic. And, you know, whether that's trying to control, you know, life after death, or or whether it's about trying to protect your crops, or trying to get pregnant when you can't get pregnant, or to help your child get well when they're sick. I think a lot of it is about power, really. It's about power and trying to ensure that there's some recourse when there's so much that's beyond one's own agency.
And so presumably what studying people's magical practices, if that's the right word, presumably that tells us a lot about the society that they're from.
Yeah, it tells us about their concerns and their preoccupations, and it often tells us a lot about those who don't have access to mainstream power in that society as well, although sometimes magical practitioners were really at the heart of things. But a bunch of the time also they were people who otherwise, you know, didn't have access to any public power, and so were attempting to use magical practices in order to change that as well.
Let's go back to the beginning, because this book is such a fabulous comprehensive survey. Let's go back all the way. What about in the ancient world? What's going on with the magic in the ancient world? Because I'm on Twitter at the moment, it's a hot day in the UK, and everyone is talking about animal sacrifices and rain dances and stuff. And it strikes me, you know, when you look at divination, people looking at entrails of animals, you know, the ancient authors are full of magic.
Yeah, I should have looked up and see if there was any specific cures, to, you know, for dry spells. But if we go back, the earliest opportunity to find in history of practicing magic appears to be like about 4,000 years before the Common Era. So ancient Mesopotamia, modern day Iraq. And there's evidence there from the palace library of an Assyrian king called Ashurbanipal, who had hundreds of clay cuneiform tablets in that library, and they are inscribed with spells and incantations. So, you know, we have to go a pretty long way back to get to the beginnings of magical practice. And then, of course, we've got ancient Persia. Herodotus talks about the magi in ancient Persia who are interpreting dreams and who are intoning over the flesh of sacrificial animals. And accusations of sorcery in ancient Persia were pretty serious. Like, you could, if you were accused of sorcery, you could have molten metal poured over your tongue to determine guilt. I'm not quite sure how it determined guilt, but that's what they did. And then in ancient Greece, as far as I can tell, is the first time we see the use of wands and also potions. Again, looking at the Odyssey, the Homer's Odyssey, we've got Odysseus taking a potion made of moly, which is a kind of magical herb, to stop Circe turning him into a pig. And one of the key concepts in ancient Greek magic is about binding. So trying to bind sort of physical or intellectual attributes of your victim to your own will. So, you know, whether you've got clay or metal figures that are literally sort of bound, and we found them, or we found papyrus with incantations on that start, I bind, or whatever. And a lot of that is imported into ancient Rome. One of my favourite things about ancient Rome is the use of amulets is quite popular there. And it was normal for Roman boys to wear the bulla, which is a phallus-shaped charm to protect against evil spirits. The book also covers, you know, sort of ancient Japan, for example. And that's an amazing example where you've got occult practitioners, Omniarchy, who are mainstream practitioners. And they become court officials. There's even a divination bureau that appoints them. And that exists, get this, up until 1868, when the Emperor Meiji disbands it. So a divination bureau. And they're doing things like exorcisms and, you know, rituals to determine whether X person can come into the court and that sort of thing.
That's very cool. When you were like working on this project, were you struck by what joins us, what binds us together as humans, our common humanity?
Yeah, I think so. It feels really amazing to look at all the examples of, you know, the rituals and the spells and the incantations, or whatever it is. The practices themselves may change, but they have, on the whole, sort of broadly similar concerns. And it is incredible when you have a look at a survey like this to see similar beliefs popping up all over the place. And And obviously it's sort of difficult because you don't want to focus on the similarity to the extent of ignoring the particularity. You know, if you think of the Pitt Rivers Museum, like that was criticised for years in Oxford because it gathers together, say, like all of the fetishes that, or, you know, all of the shrunken heads or, you know, like from different places and makes a parallel between them. But at the same time, you know, so for example, I've got really fascinated in reading this book about practices relating to divination. One of the things that we most can't control as humans is that we live in linear time and we can't see the future. So we have been fascinated with trying to predict what it's going to be. And people have used all manner of things. So in ancient China, they would cast yarrow stalks, cleromancy. And I put this on Twitter a few days ago and someone tells me, you can go into a Chinese medical shop today and buy yarrow stalks. You can still do this. Anyway, or again, back to Homer, you know, we've got divination there. Achilles is said to consult, is told to consult, or he suggests, sorry, consulting an interpreter of dreams to try and figure out why the god Apollo is angry with the Greeks. And in ancient Greek, they were particularly concerned with observing the flight of birds to try and divine the future. Or ancient Rome, they are interested in animal entrails, so the colour of livers, which is called haruspicy in the, you know, the Mexica. The Aztecs, they scatter maize kernels in patterns on the ground. And some of these things have just got the most fantastic names, you know. My favourite, I think, is from medieval Byzantium, and it's called chromistomancy, which is interpreting horses' neighs. Although the Byzantine also have paleomancy, which is about interpreting inadvertent bodily twitches.
Well, that is interesting, because of course now we're told that the great powers all have special bodily twitch experts who are reading body language of other prime ministers and presidents, aren't we? So that has actually surely come back into fashion. So, okay, what about, so I'm, that's brilliant, love divination. There's a lot of alchemy in the book, isn't there? And alchemy feels like a kind of gateway drug to science. But alchemy, especially in your period, you're so versed in the 16th century, you must see that alchemists, I mean, there was a sort of respectability about alchemists, wasn't there?
Yeah, there certainly was. I mean, in the 16th century, it's mainstream. And actually, one of the reasons we don't perhaps we don't know as much about this as we could do is that one of the major sources used for the 16th century is the state papers that were all gathered together and calendared, i.e. put in chronological order and typed up, basically, in the 19th century. And these 19th century men choosing which state papers were important didn't think the ones about magic were that important. So there's a lot of stuff in the manuscripts that hasn't really made it into much of the normal discourse. But yeah, so Dr. John Dee, obviously famously an alchemist, but also people like William Cecil and Sir Thomas Smith. So Queen Elizabeth I's court was riddled with alchemists, and she actually had alchemical laboratories at her court. But it goes back much further. The word alchemy comes from alchimia, which is Arabic, and it means transmutation. So it's about trying to change one substance into another. And you're absolutely right about it being the sort of gateway to science, because people like the 9th century Arab scholar Al-Razi were basically early chemists. So they are people who are coming up with the idea of having laboratories and distillation. And it's actually even practiced in ancient China, even before that as well. But in the Renaissance, the focus comes to trying to find the philosopher's stone, so that the thing that will help you change base metals into gold and will help you cure illness and attain immortality. And that's the focus. And the other thing to connect this with science is that people go on believing this for quite a while. So Isaac Newton, you know, one of the founders of the scientific revolution, was an alchemist. He undertook alchemical experiments. He read alchemical texts.
Heard of him? Yeah. No, I mean that's. I think that relationship's so.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
What about, okay, so another thing you cover, which I like, is similar to the Philosopher's Stone, objects, magical objects. I'm in honour of this interview, I'm wearing my lucky charm. You see, this my kids made me this little shell necklace, and I have this strange attachment to it. I'm not really an object kind of guy, but I have this strange attachment, and it's my lucky charm. And so I thought, this is my little bit of magic. What kind of things have you come across?
Yeah, so amulets are a crucial thing, so warding off evil, really. So basically stones and objects can often be thought to be receptacles of magical power. So in ancient Greece you've got hematite, which was thought to protect unborn babies, and jasper to cure stomach infections. In ancient Greece, jade was thought to keep away evil spirits, and in medieval Byzantium, sardonyx was thought to help protect against miscarriages. So quite often you'd wear one of these because you could put it in a piece of wood or a piece of bone, and then you could wear it just as you're wearing your shell. And obviously the modern version of these are the kind of talismans of St. Christopher's, medallions, or those cats with the raised paws you see in shops often, or lucky mascots of sports. But the other thing about, apart from that, and then also in the 16th century, it's quite often things like witches' bottles and shoes in chimneys and silver coins and stuff to protect against malevolent spirits. But this idea goes back, to ancient Egypt, scarab beetles, or ancient Islam, the Hamsa, the hand of Fatima. So it's been really common. And I think one of the things is that one of the parts of it is basically, I think at the heart of the idea about objects as intermediaries is that there's transference. So they will take the evil spirit as opposed to you. And in a similar way, it's been thought things like, you could use objects or animals to heal yourself. If you had plague buboes, put a live chicken against those plague buboes, and the illness will transfer to the bird. Or more malignantly, poppets. So, voodoo dolls, figures shaped to look like somebody, and you do harm to that doll in order to do harm to the person. And this is going on. What's amazing is how many places have poppets, like around the world, how common this is. You find it in Haiti, but you also find it in 1612 in Lancashire in the Pendle witch trials, clay figures being pricked with a thorn or a pin to cause pain.
Well, you once tweeted a royal advice manual pamphlet written about how to cure aching stomach, and that was to lie with a beautiful maiden. But that does kind of remind me of herbal doctor, because magic is such a fascinating subject, isn't it? Because some of it, like poppets, is just balls. And then others was obviously kind of was true because it was proto-science. So herbal healers and remedies, we now go, oh, look at that. It turns out that is a like an antibiotic or an anti-scorbutic, or so that's a whole part of magic that's been hived off and turned into science, hasn't it? So do you cover that as well, I presume?
Yeah, I think that's right. To quote you back at yourself, I remember once you gave a talk about the value of history, and you were talking about how we so often say that history is not useful because so much of it, when it works, it's become something else. Like, so, the historical experiments with alchemy becomes chemistry, and then they're like, that's our subject. It's like, no, actually, it's ours, really. But or whatever it is, the successes of things. So yes, absolutely. The therapeutic qualities of plants, sage to heal fevers, aloe vera to treat burns, things that work. But also, for example, basil to calm your mind. Now, I quite often put a few drops of basil oil in, one of those diffusers in here when I'm trying to focus. And I think that's fine. I think that works. Basil was also thought, though, to create wealth. And so far, it hasn't managed to do that. But, or patchouli, which is thought to be an aphrodisiac. Mistletoe was thought by the Celtic Druids, to bring fertility. And then one of the sort of most difficult plants of all was mandrake, which was thought to be an aphrodisiac and thought to be a cure for sterility. But it was also thought that it would scream as you pulled it out of the ground, and that its scream would kill anyone who heard it. So I guess, what's going on there? Is that just so you don't try? But the thinking behind that is sympathetic magic. So the idea is that, as you well know, that the healer would find something in nature that looked like the ailment, and then use that as a cure. So in medieval Europe, to cure jaundice, for example, they would try making a potion of mashed earthworms and old urine. The idea being that the yellow colour would act to cure the yellow tint of the jaundice. And mandrake is supposed to be shaped like a human body, so it's supposed to cure lots of things.
Crikey. And then we should talk about magicians and witches. Do you see a similar thing that you do in religion with the priesthood, where some societies develop kind of a quite hierarchical structure, and you've got witches and wizards that need training in a almost separate caste, where others are a little bit more Protestant about it, and where everyone can kind of do magic? I mean, you must see that in different cultures.
Yeah, so, I mean, in Slavic culture, what's sort of modern Ukraine, they had the witches and wizards, I suppose, or male witches as well, were called Volkovi, and that was both men and women. And they were doing things like divination and protecting against bad spirits and healing, all the standard stuff. But they were also said to be able to shapeshift into becoming bears and wolves, and they were supposed to have dragon ancestors. But the most famous of those is a woman, a wild old woman called Baba Yaga, who still appears in Russian folktales, flying around in a mortar with a pestle. In some places, the Japanese divination bureau I talked about, that's all men, but in some places it's all women. So in the Norse magic sorcerers, some of the most revered were female wand carriers, who had long blue coats which were lined with white cat's fur and black lamb's wool, and they also could shapeshift. So shapeshifting, it seems, is one of sort of the, if you're on the higher echelons of witchery or wizardry, shapeshifting and making things invisible. Yeah.
You've talked to me a lot about witchcraft and its persecution, and in a perhaps less humorous way, in 7th century France. But I mean, what other kind of spells? I mean, a lot of the spells to do with medicine and putting, and is it putting the evil eye on people? Is it like sort of both for good luck and bad luck? And then the love. Let's come to the love, because that's nice. That's nice magic, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, love spells. Well, it depends. I mean, it depends what you do, I suppose. But there's all sorts of things that can be done to try and cure sickness by tying, herbs and salt into a cow's tail. That's fairly benign. Burying a dog, not so benign. But love, right? So there's a medieval Jewish love spell, which in which you fill an eggshell with your blood and the blood of your intended. There's not much clue about how you get that, but once you've got that, you write both your names in blood on the shell and then bury it, and that apparently promises instant results.
Well, you and I have talked a lot about sort of you're obviously a world expert in the Tudors, and your recent book is astonishing on France, French history as well. So please go back and listen to those podcasts. So we're not going to talk too much about that period, because I actually would love to go on to something that I've seen a little bit recently. I've had friends and close people to me that have lost loved ones, and they're quite fascinated by spiritualism, the idea that you can talk to people after death. And it's very difficult for me because I know a little bit about it, and I know that it was particularly popular after the First World War, with these vast numbers of bereaved families were frankly taken for a ride by various sort of spiritualists who said, you know, I can talk to your deceased son, you know, these young boys through me and stuff. So it's been tricky because that seems to linger in our society, this urge to speak through mediums. Is that something that's recent, or do you see that all the way back through history?
In its modern form, the idea of having seances that you can communicate with the dead through a medium, in the West, that's been since about the 1840s. There was a couple of sisters in New York called Maggie and Kate Fox who claimed they could commune with the dead. And then it got particularly popular in America following the American Civil War, exactly as it did after the First World War, because of all these lost loved ones. And it gained popularity because celebrities endorsed it. And back to the science magic question, what's really interesting is you've got people like William Crookes, who was a leading chemist, the president of the Royal Society, supporting spiritualism. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the man who invents, you know, the most forensic-minded detective of the age. And Conan Doyle was also a member of something called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which was a kind of esoteric, secretive society that you had to be initiated into, and that assumed that there were planes of consciousness and that you could rise sort of to a mystical awakening through that. So there was a sense in which there was a hunger for this sort of spiritual belief in the 19th century. And if you think back towards the beginning of the 19th century, end of the 18th century, Gothic literature, of course, is very popular. If you think of the Castle of Otranto and Frankenstein and all that stuff, there's a real tending towards that spiritual nature. And I think ultimately it just boils down to the fact that death just seems too final, and that we don't understand. My lovely literary agent died 2 months ago, and I remember on the night that I heard the news, just going for a walk and thinking, and just really genuinely asking the question, but where has she gone? Do you know what I mean? Well, what, like asking and really being faced with the most basic of ideas of loss, and of the fact that everybody I love will die if I don't die before, you know, before that. And I think it's just such a hard idea to grapple with. So it makes a lot of sense that people are looking for an answer, and I think you're completely right that lots of people have taken people for a ride as a result of that, have played on that loss, and been total charlatans.
What and we got Dan Friedman on the chat here. He's the hardcore man. Dan's gone straight for it. He just thinks, is magic just a way for intelligent people to gain influence within their societies? Like, after working on this project, are you left thinking all these so-called magicians and things, that they're just looking to get to trick people and gain influence and power?
I'm sure that's true of some people. I'm sure there were people for whom that applies, but I also think that there were people, and this is where we have to start to grapple with the reality of different people's beliefs about things. There were people who genuinely believed that they were witches or wizards or, you know, soothsayers in the past, that they weren't seeking to hoodwink anybody, that they weren't trying to manipulate the systems of the society, that they genuinely believed it, and others believed it too. Then you have to start to look at the world in a slightly different way. And people, you know, not just confessing under torture, but genuinely confessing without torture to say, yes, I am a witch. That makes you think about people's frameworks of belief as being very different from our own.
Adrian says, what's the sort of dividing line between belief in magic and religious faith?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because quite a lot of the time there've been really blurred lines. So, for example, much of what we call voodoo, but more properly it's called voodoo belief, is syncretic. In other words, it takes elements of Roman Catholicism, mixes them in. And there are, you know, there's an 11th century English spell as a cure for dysentery, which in which you are you have to dig up a bramble root, which is a blimmin' hard thing to do, and say the Lord's Prayer 9 times, and then boil up the root with mug water and milk until it turns red. And so there's, you've got that combination of, here, go do something in nature, you know, and have some incantation, except the incantation happens to be a prayer, right? So you've got that absolute overlap. And the line between magic and miracle basically depends on the view of the eye of the beholder, I think. So we were talking about amulets and objects, but you've got someone like Charlemagne owning a couple of crystal spheres in which one of them's got a bit of the true cross and one of them's got, you know, a relic of the Virgin Mary, and he thinks these protect him. So it depends who's drawing the line between the two, what is considered orthodox and what is not.
Well, you know what, everyone? Thank you very much, Professor Lipscomb. That was fantastic. Susanna, what is the book called?
Okay, the book is called A History of Magic, Witchcraft and the Occult. It's published by DK. And you can get it in all good stores. Although I would particularly say that there's a shop called Fox Lane Books up in North Yorkshire, an independent bookshop that I've teamed up with. If you want me to sign a copy or dedicate it, I will put a book plate in it if you buy it from them. So look them up, Fox Lane Books.
What's your next big project? What's your next big book?
Next big book is about six women who aren't that terribly well known. They were married to this big fat chap at the beginning of the 16th century. He killed a couple of them, divorced a couple of them. One died in childbirth and another survived. I wonder if you can guess.
Susie, Professor Lipscomb, thank you very much for coming on this podcast. Hi everyone, it's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good. And then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.